soda water. Add 3 ounces of bourbon. Strain and pour into Collins glass. Freshens the breath. Tic Tacs may be substituted. Chicken shot. Like a bull shot, but mix chicken noodle soup instead of beef bouillon with the vodka. Your Jewish friends will particularly enjoy this drink. Clarabelle cocktail. Fill one guest with scotch, then squirt him in the face with a seltzer bottle. A nostalgia drink. Cold buttered rum. A hot weather drink. Put rum, cinnamon, and cloves in a 12-ounce glass, add cider, then use hotel butter pats instead of ice cubes. Ham nog. Combine 3 ounces of brandy with a tablespoon of sugar, 1 cup of milk, and a 1/2 cup of crushed ice. Then add sliced ham instead of an egg. Cloves rather than nutmeg may be grated over the top. Liquor daiquiri. Women expect anything in their daiquiris except liquor. Put some booze in there instead of pineapples, mangoes, peaches, or frozen bananas. Rum gumbo surprise. A bowl full of sliced okra and rum with live shrimp swimming in it. Whiskey sweet and sour. Pour 3 ounces of blended whiskey in a Delmonico glass and stir in Chinese food to taste. Zen martini. A martini with no vermouth at all, and no gin either. Sucker punch. Singapore ass in a sling. Attica sunrise. These are names for Gatorade and grain alcohol. Mix half and half. Drinks for the dog. You know you haven't had enough to drink yet if the dog hasn't been given a martini. The official preppy desk diary. Unfortunately, most dogs will not drink a martini. But there are a number of cocktails a dog will drink. Here are a few. Vodka and spoiled meat. Gin and chicken gizzards. Beer, Alpo, and dog biscuit punch. Serving drinks with a garden hose. The trick is to use one of those garden sprayer attachments made to be used with pesticide. Turning your car trunk into a punch bowl. What a good idea. Why don't you try it? How to keep the cocktail onions out of the filtration system when making a martini the size of a swimming pool. Use regular full-sized onions instead. Party food. If it really is a real party, no one will care about food. Food may still be served, however, but strictly for its amusement value. Dog food tartare. Don't tell anyone the recipe until everyone has had some. Or to drugs. Getting the toothpicks into the quaaludes is the tough part. Anchovy rolls in the hay. Scatter a tray full of anchovy rolls under the covers in a bed that you know some couple is going to sneak off and get into. Whale caviar. Actually, it's shelled goose eggs soft-boiled for 1.5 minutes. What a mess. Margarine. The ideal party spread. Spread it on the guests. Does it go rancid as fast as butter, and the gooey sticks are more erotic than Crisco cans. Pizza for 500. With everything. Have it all delivered to your boss's house or someplace like that. Raw eggs. Taste terrible, but are great in a food fight. Canned ham on a stick. Nothing could be easier. Take ham out of can and put a stick in it. Makes hilarious Oldenburg-type giant canapes for artsy crowd. Bearded clam dip. Best left to the imagination. Spaghetti as finger food. Secret is to use the microwave instead of boiling it. Soup Nagasaki. Put unopened cans of Campbell's soup into oven at 500 degrees and get out of there fast. Miscellaneous hints and tips for real party guests. The dignified way to vomit. Remain standing. With right hand, hold cocktail out to side at arm's length. Bow deeply at the waist. Include all regurgitation in one retch. Resume upright position. Use left hand to wipe mouth with handkerchief, not toilet paper. Take another drink. Five amusing places to take a leak. 1. In someone's galoshes. 2. Off the Truman balcony at the White House. 3. Into the centerpiece from on top of the mantel. 4. Through a keyhole. 5. Out of a moving convertible. Face the rear. Fight etiquette. Never fight an inanimate object. Never hit anyone below the belt, particularly a black one earned in karate. Never try to break the end off a bottle if it's plastic and disposable. Never hit anyone from behind. People should be kicked from behind. When your opponent is down, never kick him in the teeth with pointed Italian shoes. Gentlemen do not wear pointed Italian shoes. Use riding boots. Remember, it's a form of social climbing to hit anyone bigger than you are. Never hit a woman you haven't been married to at least once. Exceptions can be made if the marriage would have been sufficiently awful. You shouldn't point a loaded gun at anyone. This is not an absolutely rigid rule. An absolutely rigid rule is never ever point an unloaded gun at anyone. Thank you notes the next day. If you are in any condition to write a thank you note the next day, it wasn't a real party. 20. Going out. We don't go anywhere. Going somewhere is for squares. We just go. Marlon Brando, The Wild One. Going out is what you do when you don't have anything else to do. Going out is the modern equivalent of staying home alone. Unless they're on the telephone, modern people never stay home alone. This is because modern people cannot stand to be by themselves for more than 15 minutes. There is a strong contemporary aversion to bad company. Going out versus dating. Going out is not the same as dating. If you had a date, you'd have some place to go, i.e. over to the date's house to watch a rented video. Going out is normally done in packs. Packs are groups of people who would be friends if moderns had any. Going out can be combined with dating, however, if it's a non-sexual date. Types of non-sexual dates. The hot walker. A hot walker is a young and poor man who escorts an old and rich woman. The proper etiquette is for the young man to have pretend sex with the old woman to boost her ego. Pretend sex is just like real sex, except you pretend you didn't have it. The beard. A beard is a secret homosexual out on a date with a person of the opposite sex who is a secret homosexual too. The protocol is for these two to have several more dates and then get married to perfect their heterosexual disguises. The stalking horse. A stalking horse is a person you date in order to make the person you really want to date jealous. You have to sleep with the stalking horse, or the person you really want to date won't be jealous enough. Where to go? One problem with going out nowadays is that there's no place to go. This is the result of excessive hipness. It's no use going to a play or a movie because playwrights and movie directors are too hip for naive concepts like good and bad. But without good and bad, it's hard to have a plot. Musicians are hip, too, and refuse to make a distinction between good drugs and bad drugs. As a result, they're all dead and concerts are lousy. As for sporting events, with no good guys to root for, all the excitement has moved to the realms of union negotiations and urine testing, so there's no place to go. Not that that stops anyone from going there. The movies. The movies are so dull these days that the only polite thing to do is provide the entertainment yourself. After the movie starts, change seats frequently and fondle the people you sit down next to. The theater. For modern plays especially, a nice thing to do is to create some real dramatic action. Phone in a bomb threat. Creating a real ending for a modern play is more difficult and may require a real bomb. Opera. Always wear a tall silk hat to the opera because you can hide a Sony Walkman in there. Listen to Tommy by The Who. Rock concerts. The only way you can really show your appreciation for a good rock group is to put on an equally good show for them in the audience. Stand on your seat, throw bottles and light firecrackers, then urge everyone to make a rush for the stage. Rock stars love showy and dramatic displays of affection. If the show wasn't any good, wait outside the stage door with a gun. This will lift the rock star's spirits by making him feel as important as John Lennon. Sporting events. Whenever you go out to a sports event, it's your responsibility to make the event more fun for everyone, players and fans alike. Football. Take your cue from the pros on the field and do lots of drugs. Another thing you can do to improve the game is toss an extra ball on the field during a pileup. Baseball. Baseball is much too slow. It needs blocking. But one good thing about the way baseball players just stand there is that they make great air pistol targets. You can also make baseball more fun by dressing as an umpire, sneaking out onto the field, and giving peculiar calls. Tennis. Tennis players aren't stodgy anymore, but tennis fans are still real stick-in-the-muds. Show them how to have a good time the way college football fans do. Bring a TV and a gallon of martinis into the stands and make up loud cheers. Throw that racket. Swear out loud. Slap the ball boy. Moon the crowd. Endorsements! 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 After each match, you should run out on the court and tear up the net. Basketball. The sad thing about basketball is that many of the players are embarrassed about being such tall black people. Put burnt cork on your face, wear an extra-long overcoat, and sit on the shoulders of a pal in the audience. This will make the players feel more comfortable about their appearance. Something else you can do to take their minds off their troubles is climb up, drop your trousers, and make a pressed ham against the clear plexiglass backboard. Hockey. Hockey players are underpaid compared to many other professional athletes. Throw coins heated over your Bic lighter onto the ice to supplement their salaries. Another problem with hockey is that it's too violent. Penalties in the penalty box should be more severe to provide deterrence. Help out by pouring beer on the players in there. Olympic sports. The Olympics are even duller than baseball. Hire some half-naked cheerleaders for the fencing matches, walking races, and equestrian events. Gallery openings. There is only one truly courteous thing to do at a gallery opening. Go straight up to the artist and write him a check for the full asking price of his most expensive work. This will make the artist feel wonderful. Get the party started off with a bang, and you can stop payment the next day. Museums. Museums aren't festive enough. They're filled with dull, grungy old masters and incomprehensible modern stuff. Buy a cheerful hand-painted Elvis portrait at a local crafts fair and put a big, serious gilt frame on it with one of those little brass picture lamps at the top. Slip this into the museum and hang it in a gallery. Museums always leave too much space between their paintings. See how long it takes anyone to notice. Chic restaurants. Just as you can enliven the atmosphere in a museum by bringing your own art, so you can enliven the atmosphere in a chic restaurant by bringing your own food and having a picnic. It's cheaper, too. Chic new restaurants. Chic new restaurants require different behavior from well-established watering holes. New restaurants need lots of publicity if they're going to thrive. Try to get them some by throwing drinks at celebrity patrons or driving your car right through the place. Church. Church wouldn't seem to be a very interesting place to go, but that's not true. All sorts of perfectly normal activities, drinking, dope smoking, lovemaking, are somehow terrifically exciting when done in a church. Even a fart can be wonderfully entertaining if it happens in a confessional booth. Forgive me, Father, for I have... Dance clubs. A dance club is the one place you should never go when you're going out. Dance clubs should be reserved for business only. Palladium, Vertigo, Limelight, and so on are terrible places for partying, but they are wonderful places to give dictation to a secretary or have life insurance salesmen meet you after work. The circus. What with the number of clowns, wild animals, and people doing death-defying acts that we all know already, there's no reason on earth to visit the circus. Visit your friends instead. They are almost certain not to serve you boiled peanuts in the shell. Party crashing. Walk right in and loudly announce how rude it was that you weren't invited. It is the duty of those with good manners to instruct the less fortunate. Section 5. That part of life which is not in the least entertaining. O duty, why hast thou not the visage of a sweetie or a cutie? Why displayest thou the countenance of the kind of conscientious organizing spinster, that the minute you see her you are against her? Why glitter thy spectacles so ominously? Why art thou clad so abominously? Why art thou so different from Venus? And why do thou and I have so few interests mutually in common between us? Ogden Nash. 21. Courtesy in the workplace. The old story of the ant and the grasshopper. The ant that ye can step on, and the grasshopper ye can't catch. Finley Peter Dunn. Anyone who has good manners on the job probably won't have that job long. Courtesy does not belong in the workplace. The only thing jobs have to do with etiquette is that it's polite to have a good one and rude to have a bad one. Getting a good job. Background and training. Skills are an important factor in obtaining a good job. George Mitchell, for example, does not have any skills. He can't weld, lay brick, type, or take dictation. As a result, George Mitchell had to look for work someplace where skills were not important, and today he is majority leader of the Senate. Avoid learning useful skills, and you'll have a chance to turn out like George Mitchell. But go to dental school, and you'll drill teeth for the rest of your life. Prestigious educational institutions are a good place to avoid learning useful skills. They're also valuable for the friends you'll meet there. At least 6 of the 12 disciples would never have been able to get jobs as saints if they hadn't attended exclusive religious instruction with the likes of Peter, Bishop of Rome, and John the Evangelist. Good schools are worthwhile, too, for the enormous amount of spare time you'll have when you aren't studying. And you never have to study at a good school because it's so impressive to say, I flunked out of Harvard. But if you say, I got straight A's at Wayne State, who cares? Use that spare time to get romance out of your system by being wildly promiscuous. There's no worse career disadvantage than being married to the first person you had a crush on as a youth. Margaret Trudeau made this mistake. She married Pierre when she was 22. Then he got older and became Prime Minister of Canada, and it nearly wrecked her career of dancing without underpants in discotheques. Choosing a field. Once you have the right kind of background, the next step in getting a good job is to pick a field of employment. This is easy because there's only one industry left in the United States, entertainment. Everything else is manufactured in East Asia. So far, however, Singapore, South Korea, and Japan have not been able to develop a cheaper, better-made, and technologically more sophisticated All My Children. There are plenty of job opportunities in entertainment. Entertainment is a broad field. It covers not only singing, dancing, producing, and directing, but also running for political office, large-scale financial embezzling, national security advising, the messier kinds of divorcing, and being self-aggrandizing president of a huge obsolete corporation the way Lee Iacocca is. In the entertainment industry's best jobs, what you're paid to do is be famous. Getting these jobs can be tricky because one of the qualifications is to be famous already. However, any kind of fame will do. You could be famous for being sick all the time, like Marcel Proust. You can be famous for being dull normal, like Gerald Ford. In fact, you can be famous for having nothing to be famous for, like Joey Bishop. Probably the easiest way to become famous is to be responsible for a lot of people getting killed. This is what got Dwight Eisenhower the presidency, Henry Kissinger a huge book contract, and Charles Manson on the cover of Life magazine. Eisenhower and Kissinger did better with this tactic than Manson, but they had ironclad alibis about what they were doing during D-Day and the Cambodia incursion. The job interview. When going on a job interview, do not pretend to be a handicapped black woman. Corporations are only kidding when they say they are equal opportunity employers. Also, unless you really are a handicapped black woman, you're going to look silly with cordovan shoe polish all over your face, wearing a dress, and sitting in a wheelchair you don't know how to operate. It's much better to come to a job interview dressed in a subdued manner. Try to present a conservative and competent image of yourself. Keep in mind what kind of person is going to be interviewing you. It'll probably be a male in his late 30s or early 40s who's just recently risen to the position of personnel manager. He'll be conservative and competent himself, and he's going to want to hire people who are the same way because that's his job. But don't forget that 20 years ago, this personnel manager was wearing his hair like Chewbacca, gobbling psilocybin mushrooms and throwing oxblood on draft files. When he sees you trying to present a conservative and competent image, deep in his heart he's going to think you're a dweeb. You can get around this by waiting until the end of the interview and then leaning across his desk and saying in a confidential manner, "Sure, I'm conservative and competent, but just between you and me, if they reinstitute compulsory military service, I'm going to feel morally obligated to dress up like a circus clown, get addicted to drugs, and shoot cops." He'll dig it, and you'll get the job. Starting at the bottom. Once you've been offered employment, insist on starting at the bottom. People are forever rising from the mailroom to become heads of giant corporations. But no one has ever risen from junior management trainee to become head of anything. A junior management trainee gets to see the boss about once a year in a staff meeting. But if you're delivering mail, you'll see the chairman of the board every day and will have a much better chance of catching him snorting blow off his desk blotter, or better, trying to fondle you. Also, with your prestigious educational institution background and murder case notoriety, you'll shine compared to the members of disadvantaged minorities working with you in the mailroom, who have only a few assault and battery convictions to their credit. Promotions should come fast. Career advancement. The most important way to assure career advancement is to be helpful. If someone has too much to do, help him out. Maybe you'll have a coworker who has completed 5 or 6 very successful projects. He probably won't have time to take credit for all of them. Help him out. Advice. As you attain higher levels of corporate responsibility, you'll start getting a lot of advice about how to do your job better. Some of this will be good advice, like get in early, stay late, and take an 8-hour lunch. But most of it will be worthless. For instance, one current piece of wisdom and management technique is to emulate the Japanese. But walking around Manhattan as part of a large group of people wearing white socks, nodding furiously and taking pictures of Rockefeller Center will probably not help your career. It's much better to improve your job performance by using methods you already understand, such as taking drugs. Take a different drug every day to help you determine what kind of on-the-job behavior will be most valuable to you. If your work goes well while you're taking methadrine, You have a job requiring verbal assertiveness that doesn't have to make much sense. Methadrine is a perfect drug for the public relations field. If you find it easier to be drunk, then your job requires physical assertiveness that doesn't have to make any sense, such as shaping U.S. foreign policy. When marijuana produces the best results, your job calls for a mellow, laid-back, low-pressure style. In recessionary times, this probably means your company is about to go out of business. And if cocaine seems to be the best working drug for you, you've probably got employment in a hip, with it field like contemporary comedy. It's hard to stay hip and with it all the time. Maybe you should try something even more hip, like heroin, or mix the two together and get a job as a dead legend. Self-employment. If you're unable to find any kind of job, there's always the option of self-employment. One increasingly popular type of self-employment is suing people. You can sue anybody for anything, and there are plenty of out-of-work lawyers urging you to do so. You'll find it easy to injure yourself by shoving Sony Walkman earphones down your throat, sticking your tongue into the back of a video arcade game, trying to run your foot through a pasta-making machine, or doing any number of other oddball things with the products of major manufacturers. And all these people are liable. This is how Ralph Nader has made a living for years. Or perhaps you can start your own retail business. It should be something that doesn't require a lot of expensive machinery, perhaps in the personal service field. You probably already know how to do something that involves interaction with other people that you could turn a profit on. No doubt there is a career opportunity right in your lap, so to speak. Feel around down there. You've got it. The fruits of success. Once you have a good job and lots of money and power, good manners will follow as a matter of course. You'll be able to act as rudely as you want and still contribute to making the world a more courteous place because of how polite and nice everybody will be to you. 22. Social correspondence. Accept of me, Mary, my dear, as your Valentine, and think over what I said. My dear Mary, I will now conclude. That's all, said Sam. That's rather a sudden pull-up, ain't it, Sammy? Inquired Mr. Weller. Not a bit on it, said Sam. She'll wish there was more, and that's the great art of letter-writing. Charles Dickens, The Pickwick Papers. Unfortunately, the great art of letter-writing has fallen into complete disuse, replaced by the great art of apologizing to angry parents and erstwhile hostesses for enormous long-distance bills run up on their phones. Modern letters. Letters nowadays are used only for business purposes, usually by the phone company threatening to cut off service. The proper way to answer such letters is to call up and say, "The check is lost in the mail." Postcards. Although no one writes letters anymore, postcards are still very popular. The correct postcard has something obscene or immensely stupid on the pictorial side, but confines itself only to the stupid on the reverse or message side. A proper postcard message contains the following. Number 1, cute salutation. Number 2, comment on the weather at the place of posting. Number 3, comment on the people at the place addressed. Number 4, closing so abbreviated as to give no indication of who sent the thing. The formal postcard. When a phone call is impractical, for instance, when you're paying for it yourself, a postcard can be employed for any purpose that the formal letter used to fulfill. For instance, the postcard of condolence. Dear Bubblehead, swell weather here. Bet you're sick of snow. Sorry your daughter died in a car wreck. Ciao, us. 23. Guests, including pets and old friends from college. You see, they had asked me down to shoot, and I'm not particularly immense at that sort of thing, and they tried to rag me in the smoking room about not being able to hit a bird at 5 yards. So I got up the next morning and hunted up the most conspicuous thing in the bird line I could find and measured the distance as nearly as it would let me and shot away. I got a gardener boy to drag it into the hall where everyone must see it on their way to the breakfast room. I breakfasted upstairs myself. I gathered afterwards that the meal was tinged with a very unchristian spirit. I suppose it's unlucky to bring peacock's feathers into a house. Saki, Reginald on House Parties. The first rule of having guests is to make sure they are comfortable. Guests are the most comfortable in their own room, which is back where they came from. If they can't be convinced to go there, maybe you can convince them to go to a hotel. They should pay for the hotel room themselves. This way they'll be extra comfortable because not only won't they feel cramped, but they won't feel guilty either. The guests you're interested in seeing can all afford hotel rooms anyway. Other guests tend to be old friends from college. Benjamin Franklin said, "Fish and visitors smell in 3 days, but old friends from college usually smell already." Answer the door with a towel over your face and say it isn't you, and you aren't home, and that you don't live there besides. Pets. A pet is just another kind of guest and should be treated accordingly. As with human guests, it's always nicest if they sleep and go to the bathroom outside the house. Pets are more intelligent than old friends from college, and some pets can be trained to bring you your slippers instead of herpes. The cat, today's dog. Cats are to dogs what modern people are to the people we used to have. Cats are slimmer, cleaner, more attractive, disloyal, and lazy. It's easy to understand why the cat has eclipsed the dog as modern America's favorite pet. People like pets to possess the same qualities they do. Cats are irresponsible and recognize no authority, yet are completely dependent on others for their material needs. Cats cannot be made to do anything useful. Cats are mean for the fun of it. In fact, cats possess so many of the same qualities as some people, expensive girlfriends, for instance, that it's often hard to tell the people and the cats apart. How to tell a cat from an expensive girlfriend? If it goes to the bathroom under the sink, it's probably a cat. If it wants jewelry, it's probably a girlfriend. Girlfriends will not usually eat horse meat, unless the restaurant has an extremely chic reputation. Houseplants. The houseplant has become America's second most popular pet. This is also easy to understand. Houseplants are even more like modern people than cats are. Houseplants are on strict low-calorie diets and spend most of their time waiting to bloom. Being a guest yourself. When going to visit your own old friends from college, be sure to show up unannounced in the middle of the night. Not much is going on in the middle of the night, and your hosts are probably bored. Remember to bring a present for the hostess. A practical or attractive present is too old-fashioned. The most popular modern present to bring is a whole bunch of other people who want to stay there too. Otherwise, a bouquet of hard drugs or a live monkey is nice. Make a loud, continuous party out of your visit. Try to stay a lifetime, and don't insult your hosts by giving them money for the food and liquor you consume. They aren't running a hotel, after all. Return their hospitality instead by inviting them to stay with someone else they know. It's a nice touch when you're a house guest to make your bed. It's a particularly nice touch to make it a place of delight for your host's teenage daughters. A tip for cat lovers. Don't give your pet cocaine. 20 years ago, it was fashionable to blow marijuana smoke in your cat's face and watch it get mellow. This was fine for marijuana. Do not, however, give your cat cocaine. If you do, it will climb the wallpaper, shred the drapes, and tear apart every piece of furniture in the house looking for catnip so it can get to sleep. Then it will spend the night howling in the backyard, and after you've passed out, we'll sneak back into the house and take all the rest of your cocaine. For the same reason, do not give cocaine to other animals. In particular, do not give cocaine to animals that aren't there, such as the giant spiders you think you see under the couch. 24. The servants. Vivre, les serviteurs feront cela pour nous. Philippe Auguste Villiers. Delisle Adam. Until recently, a prosperous family employed a housekeeper to superintend the general domestic establishment, a butler to take charge of the dining room, pantry, and parlor floor, footmen to answer the door and assist in serving the table, a valet and lady's maid to attend to the personal needs of the master and mistress of the house, parlor maids, kitchen maids, and chamber maids to do the cleaning, a gardener to tend the grounds, a cook to prepare meals, a chauffeur to drive the car, and a nurse and a governess to care for the children. Today, all these functions are combined in the single person of the cleaning lady who comes in once a week. What she does is a little dusting. Before the cleaning lady arrives, it is necessary to vacuum the entire house and straighten up all the rooms, because she works for friends of yours the other 6 days of the week, and you don't want her to tell them how you really live. Be especially careful about hiding drug paraphernalia, sex toys, and the like, and get any unusual or alarming bedmates out of there before she comes. It is perfectly proper to ask your cleaning lady to iron, wash windows, polish silver, do the grocery shopping, and clean up after the dog. You can also ask her to jump through a flaming hoop with a cold leg of mutton in her mouth for all the good it will do you. She's going to dust a little, and that's it, no matter what. It is also considered quite proper to yell at your cleaning lady, allow your children to do the same, threaten to report her to the immigration authorities, and give her a lot of worthless and condescending advice about what to do with her husband, the drunk. A cleaning lady is somebody who really violates your personal space, so it's not bad manners to treat her poorly. She'll understand. And she'll reciprocate by not considering it bad manners to steal money from you to bring her salary up to half of the minimum wage. 25. Real trouble. Send lawyers, guns, and money. The shit has hit the fan. Warren Zevon. Real trouble is not the same as acting up or being intentionally rude. Real trouble results in death or a long prison term. Nothing could be more modern or more mannerly than real trouble. It produces that rarest and most exquisite contemporary sensation, the polite thrill. The lack of polite thrills in modern life. With the elimination of social complexities such as duty and virtue, modern life has come to be guided only by the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. Thus, humans have attained the same natural perfection as wild beasts. But a price has been paid for this honest simplicity. Without the pricks of conscience or obligations of rectitude to force us into dangers, our lives are no more thrilling than the lives of beetle larvae. Real trouble fixes this. If the lady next door roasts her child, preheating the oven to 550 degrees and placing the baby fat side up on a rack in an open pan, reducing the heat immediately to 350 degrees and cooking 18 to 20 minutes per pound until dead, numerous thrills are provided. There is the thrill of violent sensation, especially if you happen to open the oven door yourself. There is the thrill of importance as you carry the news to others, and the thrill of creativity as you invent things about your neighbor to tell the newspapers. And most important, there is the ultimate, fabulous, and very polite thrill of not having given in to the temptation to do this to your own kid. But it is this very thrill of not having caused the pandemonium that points out the one big problem with real trouble. It's such a bore waiting for others to get into it. Waiting goes against the impatient grain of modern life. As a result, Many people feel compelled to get into real trouble themselves, even though they know it's going to be a bother. Getting into real trouble. In order to be perfectly correct, when you decide to get into real trouble, you should make sure that it's you who gets killed or sent to jail. But etiquette is not as exacting on this point as it once was. Today, it's often considered acceptable to have lots of people go to the grave or Leavenworth with you. You must still be careful about motive, however. It shouldn't look as though you need to cause trouble to attract attention. It's always rude to remind others of inadequacies, especially your own. And you should never cause trouble out of anger. If you are mad at someone and you shoot him, real trouble will result. But you'll also lose that person's friendship. The more courteous thing to do would be to slap him with a huge lawsuit. That way you'll enjoy the trouble and he'll enjoy the publicity. Thus the wheels of polite society are oiled. Nor should you ever create trouble for a cause. Planting pipe bombs is no end of fun, but planting them in order, say, to free Croatia from Yugoslav political control looks too calculating. Also, having a cause gives others impolite thoughts about how empty your life must be otherwise. Types of real trouble. Self-destruction. The old-fashioned way to get into real trouble was by eating, drinking, taking drugs, getting diseases, and acting like a pig and a fool until you died. Today, this is considered hopelessly pokey and selfish. A clearly willful act of suicide in early youth is preferable and more interesting to the public. You should consider the feelings of others before you commit suicide. Try to kill yourself in a public place. Climb up on a bridge or out on a window ledge so that crowds can gather and cheer your urge to jump. Let at least one policeman climb out after you before you leap. This is how they get medals and promotions. If you are too shy or too afraid of heights for such a public exit, you can include others in your gesture by leaving a well-composed suicide note. Even better is to leave a number of notes addressed to various people, explaining how each of them was the principal cause of your despair. They'll be more flattered as to their importance than they would be if included in a general everybody hates me sort of explanation. Guns are always the best method for a private suicide. They are more stylish looking than single-edged razor blades, and natural gas has gotten so expensive. Drugs are too chancy. You might miscalculate the dosage and just have a good time, or you might wind up in the hospital as a human vegetable, in which case you'll spend the rest of your life being pestered to become the head of a federal regulatory agency. Some people favor committing suicide in the nude for additional shock value, but try to be honest with yourself about how your body looks naked. It's safer to wear something simple in white or light gray. Both go well with blood. And be sure to empty your bladder and bowels before shooting yourself. Gore from a bullet wound is very dramatic, but there's always an element of low comedy to excrement, as witnessed by the mention of it throughout this book. There are times and places, of course, where it would be very bad manners to commit suicide. Never commit suicide at someone else's funeral. This is stealing the show, much too pushy. The British did a lot to improve manners on the Indian subcontinent when they put a stop to suttee. Try not to kill yourself in a way that will result in your being made a martyr. The world does not need more hideous portraits printed on black velvet of the type seen depicting Martin Luther King Jr., Jesus Christ, and John F. Kennedy. Do not commit suicide to get back at your parents if they actually do detest you. You'll just be playing into their hands. Young people should not kill themselves over college grades until their final exam scores have lowered the class curve. Murder-suicide. More thrilling than the simple suicide is the suicide where a bunch of people are killed first. Try to pick people that you know. There's something vulgar about killing strangers. This is why polite people were so careful to dodge the draft during the war in Vietnam. The rules for killing people are similar to the rules for having house guests, except instead of doing everything you can to make people comfortable, you should do everything you can to make them dead. Only a very rude host would serve himself first. By the same token, only a very rude murderer-suicide would kill himself first. Try to kill people quickly. It's just as inconsiderate to torture people to death as it is to torture them with a long, boring story about your psychiatric problems. Killing strangers. With the use of tact and consideration, killing strangers can be made less vulgar, even socially acceptable. For instance, when sniping from the top of a building, try to pick people who seem to be having a bad day anyhow, and never commit only one murder. You wouldn't serve a meal with only one course. Frankly, it is common. Remember to think visually. If you commit your murders at all well, there'll be a movie made about them. Out of consideration for the producer, you want that movie to be a hit. Do your killing someplace with interesting scenery and pick victims with colorful personalities or who resemble famous actors. It also helps if you give yourself a nickname that can be used as the movie title. The Earmuff Murderer. The Six-Inch Naval Gun Killer. The Silly Strangler. And the Sock-in-the-Mouth Suffocator are several possibilities. Bombs. There is something impersonal about bombs that keeps them from ever being in the best of taste. An exception is if you are the head of government in a country with an extensive nuclear arsenal, in which case you can be confident that your bombs will affect everyone in a deeply personal manner, and you may use them at will. Hostage taking. Taking hostages is the reverse of having old friends from college come to stay at your house. When you take hostages, you've got a bunch of unpleasant, grumpy, half-crazed people on your hands, and you're threatening to shoot them if they do leave. This makes no sense, and a polite person wouldn't have anything to do with people as disheveled and silly-acting as most hostages anyway. Pretending to take hostages, however, is a great way to get rid of those old friends from college. Call the police and say you're holding your old friends from college at gunpoint. The police will then do everything they can to get them off your hands. Sexual assault. Sexual assault is very outré. The better class of people are surfeited with sex and would never think of attacking anyone to get more of it, though they might hit someone over the head to get a dinner invitation. Sexual assault is still fashionable, however, when women rape men. The literal meaning of rape is to carry away. That is exactly how most women make their assaults, by carrying away lots of expensive clothing and jewelry from department stores and clobbering their husbands with the bill. But this is not real trouble. It's not even against the law. Polite crime. Never forget that the purpose of real trouble is the entertainment of others. There should be something novel and unique about the trouble you get into. Your crime needs what newspapermen call a hook. Stake someone out at the top of the bell tower at San Juan Capistrano and let them get fluttered to death during the annual return of the swallows. Cause cancer in a kidnap victim by force-feeding him refined sugar and foods with chemical preservatives in them. Work at an abortion clinic for 10 years, then go to a Catholic country and insist on turning yourself into the authorities as a mass murderer. Call up the Guinness people, too. After 10 years of giving abortions, you've probably got their mass murderer world record. Cause an anorexic girlfriend to drown by leaving the toilet seat up at her house. Chainsaw murder has already been done, but nobody has killed anyone yet with one of those string-fed lawn trimmers. It might take a while, but it will make the papers. Accidental real trouble. Never get into real trouble by mistake. Plane crashes, car wrecks, and accidents while cleaning guns are all too impromptu for even the casual social life of today. People will tell each other, when something like that happens, there's just nothing you can say. How true. And how boring. If you're going to have a surprise mishap, try to be beaten to death by teenagers in the restroom of a public park that's known as a hangout for homosexuals. This will give everyone lots to say, especially your wife and children. The value of planning cannot be overestimated. If you are going to get into real trouble, you should start laying the groundwork early in life by being quiet, shy, a straight-A student, and a dutiful child to your parents. It gives no end of pleasure to everyone when a person like that throws a flaming bucket of gasoline into the Senate from the visitor's gallery. The consequences of real trouble. Trials. If you're not killed immediately when you get into real trouble, you'll have to stand trial. Think of the jury as your friends. That way you'll be prepared when they fuck you over. Society holds trials for the same reason that Shakespeare had comic relief in Macbeth. So try to make everyone laugh. Pleading innocent is usually the best way to do this. Also, be sure to take the stand yourself. You wouldn't care to go to a Broadway play at which the star stayed in his dressing room while a paid expert explained his part to the audience. And plea bargaining is tasteless, too much like being engaged in trade. Always dress for a trial in a manner that shows you to be a sophisticated person. You don't want people in the court to think you ran your parents through a laundry mangle out of ignorance and stupidity. Prison. If the jury comes to feel they really know and understand you, you'll have to spend some time in prison. Being in prison is just like being a guest at a large house party, except that you'll be sexually ravished without hints over cocktails first. Be sure to tip the help. If you tip them to what some of the other guests are up to, you may get an early parole, or a sharpened spoon handle between the ribs. Either way, your visit will be briefer. Death sentence. If you live in a state with capital punishment, try to think up something piquant to say on your way to the gas chamber. "See you in hell, Mom," is nice. Things like, "My only regret is that I have but one life to give for my country," or "Don't stop to mourn, organize," sound too stiff for what's basically an informal situation. Section 6. Clothing. Sitting and clothed and in his right mind. Mark 5:15. 26. Men's clothes. A man's tie should never be louder than his wife. John Hughes. How to dress in a polite way. The most polite thing in the world is to be rich. There's nothing you can do that is more courteous and mannerly. But as with all points of etiquette, appearances are everything. If you can't bring yourself to actually be wealthy, the least you can do is look that way. Therefore, any man with good manners always dresses as though he had lots of money. Dressing like a rich man is not, however, a matter of wearing flashy and expensive clothes. Life is not that simple. Everyone wants what he doesn't have. Everyone enjoys pretending to be what he isn't. It's poor men who wear flashy and expensive clothes pretending to have money. Rich men wear sturdy and practical clothes, pretending to have brains. Thus, if you want people to think you're wealthy, don't dress rich, dress smart. Besides, rich men didn't get rich in the first place by wasting good money on meringue-colored suits with shoulders as wide as the Panama Canal. The rules of dressing rich. Don't be flashy is the first rule of dressing rich, but there are hundreds of other rules that rich people dress by. Rich people like rules. This is probably because rules, such as the rule, robbery is against the law, are what keep them rich. Shoes. Rich white Protestant men have held on to some measure of power in America almost solely by getting women, blacks, and other disadvantaged groups to wear crippling foot fashions. This keeps them too busy with corns and bunions to compete in the job market. Make sure your shoes are plain and roomy. Black, brown, and oxblood wingtips, Oxfords, and slip-ons are excellent, But don't get plain and roomy shoes mixed up with sensible shoes. It shouldn't look as though you have to be on your feet all day working. Construction boots, ripple-soled shoes, and anything the mailman wears are not rich. Neither are galoshes or rubbers, which show you're too poor to buy new shoes if your old ones get ruined. Also avoid great big boat-sized policeman's shoes. Whether they love rules or not, the rich are no more honest than the rest of us, and policemen make them nervous. White shoes are very rich-looking, but they have to be the completely impractical suede kind, not shiny white imitation leather. It's a general rule of wealth that if something can be wiped clean with a damp cloth, rich people can afford to throw it away. A current rich shoe favorite is the black tassel loafer. Powerful and important men enjoy the reassuring snap of the little tassel ends. It's like having their feet report for duty every time they take a step. Don't be fooled into buying loafers with little things across the instep, however. If you really were rich, you'd know that those are snaffle bits, and they belong in the mouth of your horse, not on top of your feet. Socks. The two principal types of rich socks are itchy black wool socks and itchy white wool socks. Rich people wear itchy socks so that people trying to act rich, or people who just became rich and aren't used to it, will be scratching all the time and give themselves away. The black socks have to be the long, over-the-calf kind, because shorter ones might not itch enough. Black socks are worn with all dress clothes and some sportswear. Other sportswear is worn with no socks. Thus, rich people's white socks are never worn at all. This makes them happy. Rich people like things to last. Neckties. The single most vital piece of rich apparel is the necktie. Rich men judge each other solely on the basis of neckties. This saves a lot of small talk and resume reading. Certain neckties say, "I'm smart," meaning, of course, "I'm rich." People who are actually smart wear orange short-sleeve shirts with plastic pen shields in the pocket, make $18,000 a year designing electronic circuitry, and don't know from neckties, which shows what brains will get you. The rich like neckties that reflect the way they want the world to be, conservative, orderly, and strangling you around the neck. So never loosen your necktie in front of a rich man, or he'll think you're a liberal Democrat. Your necktie should not be so wide that it looks as though you can't afford to get soup on your shirt. And it shouldn't be so narrow that you could get it confused with the fettuccine and accidentally wrap it around your fork and make a real fool of yourself during a business lunch. Never wear a necktie with a pattern that resembles a road map, a pizza, or a Parcheesi board. And never wear a tie made of polyester synthetics. Rich people own oil wells. They want to get the most out of that oil. They want to see their oil used in expensive gasoline, not cheap neckties. Also avoid regimental stripes. If you hang around with rich people, sooner or later you're going to run into someone who is in that regiment. He may not care to be reminded of his war record. A silk tie with a small repeated game bird motif is good. This shows you are affluent enough to purchase an expensive shotgun and mean enough to use it. Rich people respect things like that. Be sure to know what the birds are, however. Don't confuse a pheasant with a duck. And if you have a duck on your necktie, make sure it isn't Daffy or Donald. Dress shirts. The proper dress shirt is always long-sleeved with either plain cuffs and a button-down collar or French cuffs and a regular collar. It should be all cotton or look as though it is. White shirts are best, but there is a short list of conservative colors and patterns that are also acceptable. Blue, pale yellow, and blue stripes on a white background. Interestingly, pink, atrociously lower class in hats, suits, cars, and politics, is considered conservative in a dress shirt. But the rich may be pulling our leg about that one. Anyway, the really important difference between the shirts of the wealthy and the shirts of the rest of us is not their material or color, but how they wear out. an ordinary man's dress shirt frays at the front of the collar from buttoning and unbuttoning and friction with polyester neckties. A rich man's shirt frays at the back of the collar, because that's where the head and neck rub when the nose is pointed disdainfully in the air. You can achieve the same effect by running some fine grit sandpaper along this part of your shirts. Don't bother about whether the shirt goes with your tie or suit. Remember,